Welcome to A Physician's Guide to Retirement, the show where we explore what comes after the full schedule, the on-call nights, and the identity of being the doctor. For many physicians, retirement isn't a single decision. It's a transition. It can bring relief and freedom, but also unexpected questions. Who am I without the role? How do I stay connected to purpose and community? What happens to relationships, routines, and the sense of responsibility that shape decades of practice? Each episode, we'll sit down with physicians who are stepping away from clinical work, some gradually, some all at once, to hear what the shift really looks like. We'll talk about the practical side of leaving medicine, the emotional side of letting go, and the opportunities that open up when your time is finally your own. From part-time work and volunteering to second careers, creative pursuits, mentorship, and learning to rest without guilt. This is an honest conversation about closing one chapter and building the next. Whether you're years away, counting down the months, or already retired and recalibrating, you're in the right place. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Imparato. Let's talk about the transition with purpose, with clarity, and with honesty. Welcome, everyone, to the first podcast from the senior and retired section of the American College of Radiology. I am your host, Joe Imparato. We are going to be discussing with you over the next few months and hopefully even years, all about that you need to know about retirement. My story is I'm a radiation oncologist by trade. I practiced for 33 years. At that point, I intended to retire, but as the saying goes, I failed retirement. I then went to work for the insurance industry, and I'm still there working full time. And because of one of our guests, Dr. Agris, we decided to launch a podcast to talk about how to retire, which I am going to use to strategize my leaving work and enjoying my next years of life. I have with me a guest, Bill Harrington. Bill worked for 40 years as a board-certified radiologist and in private practice in Athens, Georgia, where he went to both high school and college. Though his retirement had been planned at age 70, it came 1 year earlier as the demands of the president of the ACR made even half-time radiology in private practice untenable. So, Bill, welcome. And then my other guest and the impetus for this whole series, Dr. Harry Agris. Dr. Agris practiced for 36 years in radiology and nuclear medicine. And then he spent the last decade discovering renewed purpose in retirement, leading up to his writing a book, Next Years, the Best Years, Taking Your Retirement to the Next Level. Dr. Agris has lectured and he's been interviewed and been profiled by multiple organizations, including AMA, RSNA, AARS, and many others. He is currently a clinical professor at Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York and continues to voluntarily teach radiology residents at Columbia and Weill Cornell. Currently, Dr. Agris blends his love of medicine with his love of photography and donates his fine art prints to hospitals, creating more calming and compassionate environments for patients, families, and staff. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you, Joe.
So let me just start by saying, as I've said, I'm still working, but I am actually planning retirement. And I found that it was actually more difficult than I had anticipated. Certainly, you know, by the time you hit your 50s, you know, everybody's saying like, I can't wait to retire. And now here I am 70, and I still can't wait to retire. It's a bit of a struggle. And so let me start off with Bill. Bill, tell me how you decided to phase out of, you know, 40 years of practice to suddenly decide you're not going to do it anymore.
I was board certified at age 29. So I've been doing this a long time. So I'm not as ancient as it might sound with 40 years of practice. So at 69, I became president. I've been on the ACR board for 10 years. Speaker, vice speaker, chair of the Commission on Communication and Publications, and membership rather. And then I was president my last year, which involved a lot of travel. I had been an interventional radiologist the first half of my career and segued into body imaging and cancer imaging for the second half. And as I got older and the demands got greater, I found that it was really hard for me to concentrate and put up with all the interruptions, the phone calls, people walking in wanting to go over films while you're doing a complex case. And so I told my partners that I wanted to go to part-time, which was half call, half as many weeks work. And I did that about 2 years before I retired. And I switched over to doing mainly plain images, fluoroscopy, sort of garden variety radiology, where cases were shorter as regarded attention span, and found that good for two reasons. One, I think those things are undertaught now. And a lot of the young guys had never done fluoroscopy, had never done many of the procedures I was trying to teach them how to do. Maybe we're an ancient practice and still do things that nobody else does. But I think in teaching centers that a lot of people come from, they're used to specialists and you know, maybe more gastroenterologists doing endoscopies rather than ordering upper GIs. So I did go part-time for a couple of years. But then when I took on the president's job, the travel was such that even half-time, trying to schedule vacation and trying to work around things coming up at the last minute, I just decided I needed to stop. And, you know, before that 40 years of practice in Athens, I spent 7 years in the Navy, training in the Navy and a Marine battalion surgeon, worked at Portsmouth Naval Hospital before coming to Athens as a radiologist on staff there. And so I think I was a little burned out after all of that. So for me, Harry will get into a much more rigorous methodology into determining what you're going to do for your retirement. And maybe we'll come back to what I ended up doing, but I was ready. I was ready to stop working. As I've heard, I remember an academic radiologist friend of mine said they were tired of working on the hamster wheel. And sometimes it feels that way, that you're a glorified assembly line worker and it gets old after a while. And so I don't know that everybody's ready at the same time, but certainly for me, it came, I think, at a good time. And I was able to transition out of working day to day to doing more traveling and more talking to radiologists around the world and in the country. And that kind of gave me a unique perspective on radiology as well.
Well, we'll get back to your post-retirement life later in the podcast. But so, Harry, you're the impetus for this whole series. And so take me through, because obviously you wrote your book after you retired. So take me through when you decided to retire. What made you finally say, okay, I'm done?
So I think my feelings were similar to Bill's. And though his was much more, I think, complicated because he was very involved with the ACR, which was very time consuming. I loved our practice. And even though I did, I was there for 36 years. And I loved, the vast majority of it. But near the end, the volume was just getting to be insanely high. And, it was also that sort of hamster mill. And I was not very good at trying to, go super fast. And I think also as we all mature, or I'll speak for myself. I mean, I think, it becomes a little more arduous. And things like interruptions were very bothersome, even though that's obviously, what we signed up for. And the interruptions are usually, are very significant and things that you have to deal with. But I think it was pretty much burnout. And that I was considered myself very lucky. And I think, all three of us and anyone in this age group is that we were in radiology during the development of all the major, major changes. It was really phenomenal.
I'll interrupt you for a second. Just to tell you a joke I often tell, when I started medical school at Upstate Medical Center in Syracuse, we got one of the first CAT scanners. And of course, in those days, doing a CAT scan could take over an hour or sometimes multiple hours. And the joke I tell students today is, I said, the pixels on the picture you got was the size of your fist. Yeah. But still, it was amazing what you could see. It was like incomprehensible, like how much more you could see. So you're right. And PET scanning, which I know you specialized in, it's like magic. It's like now the cancer actually lights up. We light up where the cancer is. I'm no longer guessing whether I need to include those nodes or not. So you're right. It's spectacular advances.
Yeah. I mean, PET CT was a savior for me. I mean, it just combined everything between radiology and nuclear medicine, and I was just always fascinated by it. I loved it. And I thought it was like a really solid thing. But as the volume goes up, things like PET CT and certainly MR, everything got much more sophisticated. And it just, I had had enough. You know, I thought I had seen enough and done enough. And I was, the stress really was starting to get to me. So I was actually quite ready in terms of leaving radiology. I was ready to do that. However, I had not done a ton of thinking about what I was going to do after. And, you know, to get to the point that you were addressing, I basically had to get a hold of myself. I had to like figure out, how am I going to do this? And I just started making out these sheets. And this was near the end of when I was still working. And I don't know if you want to go into that now or you want to wait a little bit, but
I do want to get into that next. I just want to make one comment. You know, Bill, you mentioned burnout. Harry, you mentioned burnout. I left clinical practice because of burnout, and it was pretty severe burnout. And I think we are of the generation, unfortunately, that we're always taught to just kind of, you know, power through it. But, you know, but it gets to the point where it can significantly impact your life. So I think having to retire because you're burned out, it would be kind of nice if we could plan on retirement just a little shy of doing that. And so you came up with what you called your four sheets of planning. And I'd like to have you go into that, because I think it would be, I think most people don't, they just don't know how to quit.
Okay, sure. I started off actually just acknowledging that I was, starting to have issues with work. And, you know, I just started to write some of those things down. I started thinking about the pros and the cons and just sort of, you know, letting them free flow in my mind and solidify what I really loved about what I was doing and what was making it more complicated and more pressure filled. And then I decided to, you know, just think about what do I love? So that became one of the sheets. And that was, you know, my family, my wife, my family, my kids, my friends. I love photography, the whole list of things. And then I thought there's another list that's actually a little bit different and maybe a little more subtle. And that's what gave me satisfaction. So that was a little more conceptual in the sense of trying to understand why did I love the things that I love. So that was something like, I love to be productive. I love to be creative and I love to learn. So that's a little different than saying, you know, I love something specific. And then the third one is, what things would I like to try? And, you know, I think for physicians, that into self. I mean, but for many of us, I mean, we've been doing this thing since school. You know, we wanted to get into a college that was going to be geared towards getting us into the best medical school. And then we wanted the best internship, residency, fellowship, et cetera. And so I, in college, had a very narrow background. I was pre-med and math, and I had very little in the way of languages, history, you know, reading, you know, English lit, whatever. And I thought, you know, things I'd like to try, I would like to, you know, start doing some more of these things. Mainly, I wanted to become more creative. And as I started to think about those things, for me, that included, my big interest is photography, which I've always loved, but I wanted to really get into it and see, you know, how much I could learn about photography and improve it. And there were numerous other things, but I think going through that exercise was very helpful. In terms of deciding, you know, how to start, at least. You know, that didn't necessarily define my retirement. I've been retired for 10 years, so I've got a few years on you guys. And I just found, you know, in the beginning, I can say that Bill is doing a lot of really interesting things. And he's like off to an amazing start, and he's still involved with ACR. I think if you can work part-time and sort of ease into this, it's a great thing. And I think also you start thinking about this before you retire, even up to 5 years before you retire, it will make everything infinitely easier.
So Bill, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you, like, you know, when that last day came and, you know, you shut down your computer and, you know, turned off that work phone, what did you get into? What did you decide to do with your time?
Well, Joe, like I said, you know, I still had the ACR doobies. So I retired at the end of June to correspond with the July start date for someone new coming in. But I was still president of the ACR through the next ACR meeting, which was in May of 2024. And so that was sort of the end, but I've maintained a lot of friendship. Got another couple that are good friends of ours who I won't say their names, but we vacation together. We were just in New York and Blowing Rock together over the New Year's. I play golf. I have played golf. I'm playing a little more golf now when the weather permits. But, you know, since the end of the really active ACR stuff, things like this, I've been on a few other little committee things that I've been asked to do, pretty much been whatever I want to do. And I had other interests. I had lots of interests. And like Harry said, and you did too, Joe, I mean, we started at an age where CT was magic. I remember going to National Children's as I trained at Bethesda, and they had a real-time ultrasound machine. And I had been working with B-Mode, and I thought, holy smokers, anybody can read ultrasound when you got one of these things. So we've had to teach ourselves a lot of radiology that occurred after our training. And so And I think most physicians are like that. They just love finding things out. And so I sort of channeled that. There's a number of things you can do. I'm in a university town. You'd monitor university courses. There are university courses that you can take online. I don't want to necessarily steer one to one or another, but you know, there are college level lectures that you can subscribe to at very low cost. And in YouTube, for example, there are some wonderful sources on YouTube, like the Royal Institution in London, where they give science lectures, and they give them in the very same lecture hall where Michael Faraday gave his lectures on electromagnetism. There's a thing called the Curator's Corner from the British Museum, and they tell you about artifacts that are especially valuable to the museum and what's the history of those. U.S. Naval War College has great lectures on geopolitical things that it's not just military battles. If you're into military battles, World War II Museum has a whole series of lectures. And so there's tremendous corpus of information that are very good and trustworthy. And since I mentioned YouTube, one of the things I did do to prepare for retirement, because I didn't do any lists, like probably wasn't as rigorous, but I had plans. And one of the YouTubes I watch, and anyone can just Google this and find it or search it, is a TED talk on the four phases of retirement. And I'm in the first phase, which is what the psychologists term the vacation phase. You don't have any responsibilities. You don't want to shave today. You don't have to. You get up, do whatever you want to, and eat when you want to, and go to bed when you want to. And if you wake up in the middle of the night, you don't have to worry that, man, I got to get back to sleep because I got to get to work in the morning. I get some rest. You start reading if you want and then fall back to sleep. We'll progress through those phases, I think, as time goes on. In the end, the end phase is you find something very satisfying of service that you like doing and isn't so rigorous that you feel like you're in a job again, but you feel fulfilled. And I think the other thing that Harry points out in his book, which I've read, and it's very good, is you have to maintain social interaction. So I don't sit around at home watching YouTube videos and taking college courses. I'm in a men's book club, which is very erudite. College professors, lawyers, former president of University of Georgia, who was in a think tank after he left UGA. So we've got a very varied group of men, and we read classics and what we consider great works of nonfiction and classics for fiction, but mostly nonfiction, current affairs, biographies, those sorts of things. And then the golf, and then we've got a group that gets together for supper every Friday night of friends. So I think the social interaction is something you really have to maintain because I think becoming a hermit can be extremely unhealthy.
Let me expand on that because that I think that's a very critical point. And Harry, I want you to go into this as well. So I think for a lot of people, work sometimes fulfills a lot of social need. So you go in, you got your colleagues, you got your staff, you got secretaries, your technicians, then you got your various committee meetings and your other responsibilities. And then that comes to a halt. And I recall I served as a president of the Illinois Division of the American Cancer Society. And I vividly recall that the 2 years were extremely busy. But then when the term ended, it was so bizarre because now you're not getting those phone calls anymore. No one's emailing you. You know, it's just that incredible, you know, drop off. And I think that's the fear of a lot of people, including myself. And it's kind of interesting. In Florida, where I spend the winters, socialization is extremely easy because almost everybody's retired and everybody's pretty much there for the same reason you are. And so getting together as groups or couples and going out to dinner or playing golf, which, as I told Harry, I'm not a big lover of golf, but I'll cough up nine holes periodically. You know, but when I go back up north, it's a little bit more challenging in finding things like men's clubs, you know, men's book clubs, things of that nature. I think it's a little bit more difficult for men than for women, who oftentimes intrinsically are more socially oriented, and there are more opportunities, perhaps for women. So Harry, like, what did you do as far as socialization after you finished working?
I think that's a great question. I still stayed in touch with a few people at the hospital. I lived in New York City, and the hospital was in northern New Jersey. So there was a little bit of a barrier there. But in the meantime, we had developed a lot of friendships outside of medicine. And I think that's, that is probably the single biggest thing, is we had a very busy social life. And then experienced the same thing down in Florida that you did, Joe. And I think, you know, sort of on the same subject, I think for physicians, one of the biggest problems with this whole transition is that you get so enmeshed in your self-identity as a physician, and it becomes very, very difficult to get over that. I think if you can do part-time work, that is fantastic, and then ease into this. But one of the key things, I think, is that, certainly socialization is crucial. You, for example, when Bill was talking, saying, you don't want to be a hermit, you know, it's fine to take some classes like that at home, but the ideal thing is to mix that with going to actual courses where you're going to meet new people who have the same interests, and you're going to be in, and when you take a course, whatever it may be, to learn, a language, to learn how to paint, how to sketch, anything like that. You want to keep running into the same people, in a way that it makes it a very easy thing to socialize. I think there are a lot of ways that you can socialize, but the enmeshment part, I think, is really tough because we have seen ourselves as doctors for so long. And, I can just give you one example. As I started to do my photography, I wanted to sell my photographs. And, we make a phone call as a physician and, people pick up, they respond. No one puts you on hold for very long. And you approach them, as a photographer or an artist, and they don't even, forget it. I mean, they won't call back. You're a second-class citizen. And I think we're used to a certain level of recognition. And it's very, very hard to give that up. And I would just try to encourage people to try different things and give yourself permission to not be that doctor. This is the other key point, and why this is so important, I think, is that now with longevity, this can be 25% of your life. This can easily be 20 years, hopefully 20 years or more of your life. And if you think about what happened between 20 and 40, and when you were 40 and 60, a huge amount goes on. And I think that's what's going to be happening for many of us as we retire. And that certainly has happened for me. And I think it's important to really start thinking about what you love and what you would really like to do, and sort of, get out of your mind that you are only a physician. And then, the other part I think Bill, alluded to was, you can do, things that are fun and all that. It's really crucial to be happy. But one of the things you want to include in the mix is, contributing to others. I think physicians are obviously very geared towards that. And you want to either do, some kind of teaching, whether it be in medicine or something that's non-medical, or you want to volunteer. And those are some of the things I think that give you added fulfillment. And once you start combining, all the kinds of things that Bill's talking about that, for you that are specific to your interest, and you do a little bit of volunteering or teaching, then you start having a whole wonderful new life that's separate from medicine. And I can guarantee you it can happen because there are millions of options.
So the volunteer part, it's fascinating you bring that up. And I actually started looking into some of the aspects. I'm on the faculty of the medical school, and with Astro, I signed up for their mentorship program. I give lectures occasionally at the medical school. One of the interesting things was I tried to volunteer at my grandkids' schools. So the grade schools, they're currently all in grade schools. And I also went to the high school and volunteered to speak to this group of kids that think they're interested in going into pre-med. And afterwards, I spoke to the teacher and I said, you know, I'd be more than happy to participate in this on a more regular basis, either deciding, you know, finding other people to come and speak or talking to them a little bit more. And the response that I was given was, we have no community volunteers anymore. Now, this might be unique to our school district, and it's very possibly the case, but there's so much concern about, you know, making sure you're protecting the kids that they don't have any community volunteer. I said, you know, I'm a physician, and I've been fingerprinted for my medical licenses. My job at the insurance company requires me to have a background check quarterly. I said, you know, I'm about as clean as anybody you can find. And so it is funny that there are some challenges when you try to volunteer. One of the things you brought up in your book, which I actually started looking into, is AARP actually has a large number of different types of volunteering opportunities, which had never even crossed my mind to look into that. But, you know, it's anywhere from teaching kids to read or working in a food bank, or even helping other seniors to avoid fraud, computer fraud, or helping with computers. So that was actually pretty exciting to me to see that these opportunities, you know, are all out there. I think, and I want Bill and Harry, I want you to address this. So, you know, as we go through this series, we're going to cover a variety of different topics. But one that I just want you to touch on is, I find that many physicians in our generation who've been in very, you know, good careers, there is a underlying fear of finance. And even though they have more than enough money to last them the 20 or 25 years that they're going to, you know, have on this earth, I think there is still always an underlying fear of, you know, do I have enough money to actually retire? You know, to really go without a paycheck anymore. So I'd be curious, obviously, you know, I would give specifics, but just like, how did you approach that? You know, Bill, like, what made you say, you know what, I got enough, I don't need any more? And like, did you kind of come up with an internal budget, or what gave you the confidence? I guess that's really the question. What gives you the confidence to say, I'm good?
Employment's going up, and they talk about, well, inflation's not flat, but wages are beginning to grow now. So wages will equal inflation. Well, that's great for the people who are still making wages. For those of us who have a more fixed income, that's not exactly how it works. No, we had a pension and profit sharing plan. I won't mention the company, but most of them do this. And my next door neighbor, who's a good friend and one of my golfing buddies, is the guy through which my account is handled with an investment firm. And they have a service where they can give you a snapshot. What's your net worth? What is your expected income based on how much money you have here? You know, I'll be experiencing next year, because I'll turn 73 in 2027, I'll have to start doing the minimum withdrawal, MB. And so there are different things you have to learn as you go on. I have a good tax man who helps and help with the quarterly holdings that you have to have just taken straight from your bank, because now you don't have an FIT. So there are little hurdles. There are hurdles like Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans and all that sort of stuff. So we've got a lot of things.
That's going to be yet another topic for us to address.
What I did was I kind of had for over several years, just an annual sort of snapshot of this, you know, using relatively conservative growth figures. This is what you can expect to be taking home. And this should last you through end of life. And that figure was fine for me. So
the point you bring up, and I want you, Harry, I want you to address this, is I think one of the keys as you start to plan retirement is make sure you have the financial advisors in place to help you with that decision. And I think, and I wonder, Harry, if that's part of the reluctance for some physicians to retire is they've never really gotten the established, you know, financial or tax advisors that they know really well and have spent years with and you know, and trust.
Well, that's exactly what I just wrote down. I've always been, I say, relatively financially conservative. But I started in the middle of my career. I had a financial advisor and I was, you know, I lucked out. Sometimes you have to go through a few, but I got a group that, you know, that's what they did. And I, you know, I am not actually great at financial things. I'm not into the market. I don't follow it. I'm in the market, but they're the ones who are making these decisions. And it's always been a wonderful thing to have someone who can really advise me, who has many other clients just like me in medicine and other fields. And the thought of what it would have been like if I had not done that, that's certainly very scary. So I actually just wrote down the single most important thing is getting a good financial advisor, preferably someone who does not sell insurance, okay, where there's not an ulterior motive that this is what they do. The ideal thing is, I think, if they are advisors and do a private wealth kind of work, that they are also invested in the stocks that you're invested in. And then that gave me a lot of faith that they were going to, you know, be doing something that was going to be good for them and for me. And again, start way before, you know, and we're talking about, you know, thinking about all these other things, these non-financial things, maybe 5 years before you retire. The financial part, I think you have to start in the middle of your career and just make it part of it. I certainly know people who, you know, have multiple homes and all kinds of, you know, things that I thought, you know, I did not need, you know. And so if I had all those things, I would not be as comfortable as I am now. So I completely agree with what you're saying.
One of the aims of these podcasts, for me at least, it's not really intended for people like either already retired or 3 days before retirement. But I did, to your point, Harry, I think you really need to plan 5, maybe possibly even 10 years in this day and age of when you're going to retire, and you know, establish, like you said, you know, you get established with a good financial advisor, a good tax consultant, so that you have this information on a yearly basis, Bill, like you said, a yearly snapshot, so you know where you stand at all points and when it's safe for you to, you know, to call it quits. And so I'm hoping that we, you know, target to some degree a younger audience, because I think a lot of people neglect that. You know, as long as a check is coming in every couple of weeks, you know, I don't really need to worry about what I'm going to do when I retire. I'll just keep on working. And then when you do go to retirement, you're just not ready for it.
You know what? Well, one thing I would, you know, that you're making me think of is, I mean, you know, the word is advisor, and I talk to them multiple times a year. And anytime I have a major decision, you know, do I want to upgrade an apartment or whatever? I went through all that with them, and, you know, they talked me down from some things. And said, that's crazy. You know, you don't really have that much. And if something changes, you're going to be paying a fortune that you don't really have. And the other thing I think is, I've heard people say that they don't want to get an advisor because there's a fee. And I would just say that I don't agree with that. I think you pay a fee so that someone who knows a lot more about how to invest, you know, is doing it rather than you, unless you happen to be really spectacular at it. And I'm not sure there are that many doctors. There are doctors who think they're great at it, and they get tips and they go, you know, nuts on the stock. But, you know, I don't think, you know, a lot of people I know and myself are not experts in this. So I was always very happy to pay a fee. And when you know, I didn't want to outpay, you know, I did a little, you know, overpay. I did some research, and, you know, I've been very, very happy. And the thought that of, you know, that if you aren't confident about the financial status, that will affect everything. I mean, that could keep you staying in practice way past when you really want to be in practice. can make you anxious, certainly about retirement. So, you know, I agree with you, Joe.
Yeah, there's a famous saying, you know, doctors are poor businessmen. I mean, that was, you know, it's always kind of the mantra. And it's because we're doctors. I mean, that's what we are. And I think you bring up a very good point, Ari. I think there are many physicians who think they are good businessmen and decide to kind of control the finances entirely themselves. And some are very brilliant and make phenomenal decisions. But for the majority of us, that we focus on our medicine and not on the finances. So establishing good financial relationships with people you can trust to help guide you, I think that's a very important step. I want to get to one more topic. So one of the issues with retirement, people will tell me, and they'll say, you know, you got to retire so you can travel. And I say, well, you know, I travel as much as I want right now. And I'm a guy that if we go on 2 week-long trips or 1 2-week trip to, let's say, Europe or someplace like that, that's like, that suffices for me. But we also have friends who go on innumerable journeys, one after another. And in fact, they just put on Facebook that they've visited 72 countries, you know, over the past, whatever, 5 years. And they've been to Antarctica, China, and everywhere else. How do you guys look into that? So like Bill, like, have you found yourself doing, like, you know, nonstop journeys across the world?
No, I've had the opportunity to do a lot of traveling. I haven't visited 72 countries, but I've visited a lot. And my wife, first generation American, both of her parents were from Greece. So we're headed to Greece shortly after the ACR meeting, and we'll be there for 12 days. And there's tons of family there, but it's not just Greece. We've been to Italy, Austria, Czech Republic, and the Marines. I spent 2.5 months in the Arctic Circle in northern Norway. I don't recommend. But I think the thing with travel for many people is you need to realize that there will be a time when you will have some health issues, and that will limit your desire to do travel outside the continental United States. And so I think it's important that you don't keep putting off, even when you're in practice, don't put off travel. If the opportunity presents itself and you can take a trip and you go, well, but I can always do that when I retire, don't count on that. You could have a health issue even before you retire that could severely curtail your ability to do that. And, you know, Harry was talking about the second home. I have a couple of friends who have mountain houses in Western North Carolina and North Georgia, the Tennessee mountains. Be careful about where you put your retirement home, because again, you're going to be older. Is there 911 where that retirement home is? How good is the local hospital if you're having a cardiac event? How quickly can you get somewhere? So, and I've seen people move to be near their grandchildren. Well, that's great. You're near your grandchildren. You don't want to drive your children nuts by coming over and visiting your grandchildren all the time, but you've just uprooted yourself from all that social network you had built, friends that are friends of yours because your children went to school together. And you also want to make sure that you all your friends are not physicians, hopefully. They're all kinds of people, and you've met them through all kinds of social interactions in the community where you worked for so many years. That uprooting can be not as nice as you might think it would be from people I know who've experienced that. So there's some pitfalls. And again, I think maybe future podcasts, we can sort of examine those.
I think that's a great topic for us to visit more in depth. Harry, I'd be interested in hearing your opinion.
I think that is huge. I think not waiting to do these things, you know, especially traveling. We did a lot of traveling while I was in practice. I happen to have a strong interest in it, and it is very much driven by photography. And I found that trips were much more interesting to me when I got more involved in photography, because I was always looking for an unusual, you know, culture, unusual, you know, scene, or, you know, something that you know, piqued my interest, but I was much more focused because I was always looking for, you know, quote, a great shot. I think that idea that Bill said that, you know, you're going to wait till you retire to travel is indeed, it's a pretty dangerous thing to do because you really don't know where, you know, when or where something is going to strike that's going to limit your physical ability or mental ability.
Yeah, it's interesting. We did recently a tour of the national parks. So Grand Canyon, Bryce Canyon, Zion. And, you know, if you want to see some of the more spectacular sites, there are parts of it that are fairly rigorous. And to your point, Bill, you know, you do it and you say to yourself, boy, glad we're doing this now because, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this 5 years from now. So I think that's a really important point. Not to take your health for granted probably would be the moral of the story. And health issues is yet another subject for a future podcast that I want us to get into.
I have one other thing that I think would be good for a future podcast is I think it's really important to have a list of in one document of all your important information. And that's extensive. So that has to do with your bank accounts, with all your insurance information, all the contacts that are necessary for that, your passwords, everything in one place, because you don't know, you don't have to die to not be around and help with, you know, if someone has a stroke, whatever it might be, and all of a sudden the family members have to figure out where all the finances are and where the insurance is. It's a wonderful thing if you can leave that document, and it's a lot of work one time, and after that you just check it out every, you know, once a year, twice a year, and, you know, make whatever changes are necessary. And I can tell you, I mean, my dad was an internist, and he was one of these old time docs, and he, you know, really did everything himself, including the accounting. And then he had a stroke during a bypass surgery. And none of us had any idea. My mom, nobody in the family had any idea where anything was. And, you know, it was, there could still be stuff floating around
out
there.
Unfortunately, it's not a unique story, especially for the prior generation. But I think the concept of a, you know, whatever they call it, you want to call it, emergency packet or anything else, I think it's very valuable. And again, something we can explore. So at this point, what I want to say to the audience is we are open to any ideas, suggestions, questions that you might have. If you'd like, we have an email address, and it's ELAGRECA. So ELAGRECA at acr.org. So please don't hesitate to send us an email, whether you want expansion on a particular topic or if you want us to address a topic or ask us a question. Obviously, none of us are in the area of giving you know, personal advice, but it may raise questions that we might not have thought of that other people might be wondering the same thing. I want to thank guests Harry and Bill. Well, you've been phenomenal and your wealth of knowledge. I strongly suspect I'll be having you guys back on as we explore future topics. But thank you very much. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Joe. That was a pleasure.
As we wrap up today's episode, remember, retirement in medicine isn't just a name. It's a handle, a chance to step back from the pace of clinical life while carrying forward what matters most, your values, your relationships, and the parts of you that exist beyond the white coat. If this conversation resonated, share it with a colleague who's starting to think about what's next, and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And if you have a story, a question, or a topic you'd like us to explore, send it our way. We'd love to include your voice. Until next time, take care of yourself the same way you always cared for others.